Hi, this is Arnie Arneson, and this is the Tuesday edition of The Attitude. I want to remind everyone that while we're Zooming on Monday afternoon, you'll be hearing this on Election Day. I can't believe we're actually here. Before I introduce my first guest, I want to remind you that this will be the last day you hear the powerful testimony of Lieutenant Colonel Vindman during the impeachment hearings of 2019. We have been doing his statement to those folks at the impeachment hearing every single day except for two since March of 2020. When I first heard him tell his father that it would be okay, I had this sinking feeling in my pit of my stomach that not only was it not okay for him or his twin brother, but that it probably would not be okay for any of us until someone actually walked President Trump out of the building. So of course, today is the last day you hear Lieutenant Colonel Vindman. By the end of perhaps this week, we will know the consequences of this Tuesday election. Now, Lieutenant Colonel Vindman.
Next month will mark 40 years since my family arrived in the United States as refugees. When my father was 47 years old, he left behind his entire life and the only home he had ever known to start over in the United States so his three sons could have a better and safer lives. His courageous decision inspired a deep sense of gratitude in my brothers and myself and instilled in us a sense of duty and service. All three of us have served or are currently serving in the military. My little brother sits behind me here today. Our collective military service is a special part of our family's story in America. I'm grateful for my father's brave act of hope 40 years ago and for the privilege of being an American citizen and public servant, where I can live free of fear for mine and my family's safety. Dad, I'm sitting here today in the U.S. Capitol talking to our elected professionals is proof that you made the right decision 40 years ago to leave the Soviet Union and come here to the United States of America in search of a better life for our family. Do not worry. I will be fine for telling the truth. Thank you again for your consideration. I'll be happy to answer your questions.
We're going to go to Texas first. And no, it's not Scott Braddock. It's Glenn Smith. But of course, he's also as important in Texas politics as anyone else. He's an author, an activist, a political consultant. He's with Progress Texas. He worked on Ann Richards' first campaign for governor. And Glenn, I'm going to ask a favor. I want a point of personal privilege. So what happened was someone posted something on my Facebook page and it was beautiful. And I have this dream that I will get this to Joe Biden. And if Joe Biden actually wins the election and he gets sworn in January, that he shares this very short vignette with all of America. So I'm going to read it to you because I want at least I want it out in the ether, if nothing else. And here it is. There was a farmer who grew excellent quality wheat. And every season he won the award for the best grown in his county. One year, a reporter from the local newspaper interviewed the farmer and learned that each spring, the man shared his seed with his neighbors so that they too could plant it in their fields. How can you afford to share your best wheat seed with your neighbors when they're entering their crops in the same competition with yours? The reporter asked. Why, that's very simple, the farmer explained. The wind picks up pollen from the developing wheat and carries it from field to field. If my neighbors grow inferior wheat, cross-pollination will steadily degrade the quality of all the wheat, including mine. If I am to grow good wheat, I must help my neighbors grow good wheat too. The reporter realized how the farmer's explanation also applied to people's lives in the most fundamental way. Those who want to live meaningfully and well must help enrich the lives of others. For the value of a life is measured by the lives it touches, and those who choose to be happy must help others find happiness. For the welfare of each is bound up with the welfare of all.
And beautiful.
It's beautiful. It's beautiful, Glenn. It's beautiful.
I love that story.
I cried. You know, I read it because I'm like, that's the ethic that he brings into the White House. And the story being told through the story of a farmer is even so, I think, even more important and more poignant. And it kind of reminds me of a story that I used to do lots of graduation speeches. And I would always begin a lot of them with the story of the old French general. And again, it's a farmer story. And this old French general asks his landscaper to come in. and he had just bought this huge tract of land. And he says to the landscaper, I want you to plant olive trees. And the landscaper looks at him and says, but my general, it will take you maybe 100 years before you get olives. And the general chuckles and says, then plant them quickly. So those two stories, in a lot of ways, are like really, they capture the moment that we're in. And I wanted to start on this election day by sharing those stories. But on election day, Texas could be in the mix. So Glenn, I want to know what's happening. As you were about to come on the air, you were looking at a decision by a federal court that was hearing a last minute Republican bid to toss ballots out in Texas. This is right after the Republican controlled Supreme Court unanimously decided that those ballots were okay. They were kosher. They could be counted. But of course, the Republicans, who are so angry about anything that even resembles a vote, decided that they should appeal it to the federal court. So tell me, as we are coming on the air this Monday afternoon, what did the federal court decide?
Well, Judge Hannon, appointed by W. Bush, a very conservative judge, ruled that the plaintiff's case was flawed. They were wrong on the law. He left it open on appeal and said if the Fifth Circuit should, another conservative panel of judges, by the way, should turn it over, I might prohibit early voting on E-Day. I don't even think that will happen, but those 127,000 votes Republicans wanted to toss out, thereby disenfranchising citizens, they're safe. They're going to be counted.
So let's remind everyone, these were about a decision in Harris County to allow drive-through polling places. And as a result, as you mentioned, 127,000 folks drove through, cast their ballots. And of course, part of the reason why these Republicans were challenging this is that isn't in a rural Republican county, it is Harris County. And Harris County is kind of a liberal left-leaning county. It's also huge. So it's not surprising, given what's happening with COVID, that a lot of opportunities are being offered to voters, not only so they can exercise the franchise, Glenn, but to also keep them safe. Am I correct?
You have it exactly right. And I just want to say this all turned on with the drive-through voting by a statute in state law that says that voting must take place inside a structure. All right. So they did. You had to drive your cars into structures at these early voting sites that you had drive-through. And I have made the argument, and I made lawyers laugh because they don't like these sort of like, you know, colloquial arguments. But I said, what's the difference between driving a car into a building or riding a horse into a building or a wheelchair or roller skates? Because they had to vote on voting machines just like you do at any polling place. But we're successful in it now. And so we can move forward. And I'm going to promise you surprise after surprise in Texas when the votes are counted.
Glenn, did any of those courts, either the federal or the state Supreme Court yesterday, say anything about the fact that these 120-something thousand people had already voted? So if we toss these votes, they're never going to be able to vote again. It's not like they're going to be able to come back tomorrow.
Well, actually, they could.
We didn't get to that point. Yeah, we didn't get to that question. So no, they didn't address it.
Well, and so my understanding was that if they, God forbid, did toss them out, that they were going to identify those 127,000 people and try to get them in on election day in case those ballots were tossed out. But you know that that is an incredible challenge on top of all the other work that has to happen on election day, counting all the absentee ballots with this huge surge in Texas. So Glenn, what does this huge surge mean? We have been talking for months now about the fact that Texas is a low performing state when it comes to voting. And that's in part because voter suppression is something that's kind of the name of the game. They make it very difficult for you to vote in Texas. So it's not only that it's Republican and makes it hard to vote. But for whatever reason, it seems like, one, you had a governor who expanded early voting by an extra week because of COVID. And now you've got these kinds of really creative things happening in places like Harris County. What do you think that means for the result? Is this the year that the state that has promised to turn blue sometime in our future could actually embrace that color this election cycle?
Yes, is the short answer. And I spent the weekend trying to find holes in the argument that we were about to go for Joe Biden. And I couldn't find the holes. Let me tell you, and to your question, Democrats have had room to grow their turnout. Republicans have basically capped out. So when we have this many more voters, a higher percentage of them are going to be Democrats, right? Because Republicans have been about the same place, somewhere around 5 million votes or so. So if we have 11 million or 12 million voters this time, which we very likely could have, you can see that the Republicans capped out somewhere in the 5 million range are going to lose. So I think it's going to be a big surprise. And also, one reason you don't hear more about it from the analysts and the commentators and the pundits is because it's really hard to model these unexpected turnouts, who they are, how they're going to vote if they do show up. And so people aren't really just doing the raw arithmetic. It could show, wow, it could really change Texas for good.
Well, you know,
including the Senate and House and legislature.
We don't have enough state Senate seats up. Now, we could, yes, we could bring in MJ in the race against Cornyn. And it, I think we will flip the House. I think we'll win. We needed 9. I think we're going to win 10 to 14 House seats.
Unbelievable. Well, actually, the most important thing, frankly, to be honest with you, I mean, I want Biden to win Texas. There's no question. It would be great to see some members of Congress come in and even the Senate. But the House is important because this is the census year. This is the time where we're going to start looking at how we redistrict. And that is where the power is. And I mean, I hope they're fair. I hope they're fair. I hope they don't gerrymander like Republicans. Just because they had the power and they could do that kind of crap doesn't mean that they should. But just being fair in Texas will change the political landscape, given how many people have moved to Texas. Scott Braddock tells me, even with the pandemic, that there are close to 1,000 U-Haul trucks still coming into Texas almost every day. So you know that the Texas of 2020 is not the Texas of 2015 or the Texas of 2010. And those new people come in with interesting political portfolios, economic portfolios, and social portfolios. And they're not wedded to a certain name because they don't know them, all right? They're not wedded to a certain party because they're moving from place to place. So I think you're absolutely right. I don't know if there are any holes for Joe Biden because I think those new folks are looking at opportunity. And I don't think that they see opportunity with a guy that wants to fire Fauci and wants to deny COVID and doesn't realize that until you resolve the pandemic, you're not going to fix the economy.
I think that's right. But I do want to add my dream scenario for election night, because I think Texas could get called early. I think the counting here is going to go fairly smoothly. And if Biden should win Texas, there is no route to victory for Trump. So whatever stunts he tries to pull in Florida or Pennsylvania no longer matter. If Biden wins Texas and we know it early, the whole election is over with. Now, that's a dream scenario, but it's a great one.
Who is that?
So Glenn, I was talking to a friend of mine who's another political consultant, and he said, well, I'll either be sitting in the fetal position rocking at the end of the week, or you'll have to be pulling me off the ceiling because I will not be able to believe it. I don't think it's going to be close. I think it's going to be one way or the other. I just feel that because I don't know. But talk to me a little bit about the organization, because Beto has been saying since 2018, I mean, we saw with the Beto race where he lost by 2.5 or 3 points against Ted Cruz. I mean, I know that Ted Cruz is kind of a well-known name and Beto was less well-known than Ted Cruz, but Ted Cruz was probably the most hated person in the United States Senate. And I think there are a lot of Republicans who are thinking, well, it's not a problem if he doesn't come back. But Beto could feel it. And he really tapped in, I think, to sort of that emerging voter, because in a lot of ways he mirrored them. I think he really did. So tell me how the Democrats have been organizing in Texas, because part of the problem isn't just feeling something. It's really getting the grassroots organized to be able to turn them out. So how have they been behaving in 2020? I mean, the Democratic Party vis-a-vis really pulling these people out and getting them organized and showing them their power.
I could make a couple of points on that. And I think the first point is really, really important. And it requires me to give some historical context. Texas, like many of the southern states, with the passage of the Civil Rights and Voting Rights Act, moved further and further to the right as voters left the Democratic Party for the more segregationist, racist Republican Party in the South. That's what we were running against. And I somehow have to speak out against those who think that every election is an even up fair fight and the best team's going to win, because here we were running against a cultural wave, a regressive cultural wave that was going to be really impossible to stop. The second point is what's happening this year. We're going to be close. I think we're going to win, but at least we're going to be really close, closer than Beto in 18. That work has been going on year after year, decade after decade, as we built towards this. And I want to give people credit who have stayed here and done that hard work, knocking on doors, talking to friends and colleagues, making phone calls. I mean, it's not easy when you're so far behind. Now, to your point, it's happened this year after Beto. I've never seen so many resources from national sources come into Texas to try to turn the state blue. In the past, the National Democratic Party and others come here and take money from our funders and spend it somewhere else. This year, they have devoted sufficient resources to Texas to where the organizations that do voter contact and persuasion have the resources they need to do it. And it's the first time really since 1994 that that's been true.
Wow. So another hotspot is Texas with COVID, especially in the El Paso area. But there has been this real sense of dissatisfaction with Governor Abbott, that Governor Abbott has really not offered the kind of quality leadership that one would need and able to address COVID-19. Obviously, the president is completely out to lunch on that whole issue. How has the pandemic been playing out as an issue for voters? Because not only do you have the organization that you just talked about, not only do you have the money, not only did Beto show you something, but I think you have a group of reliable Republican voters. They kind of care about their kids. They kind of care about their grandparents. They kind of care about their schools. And they're not wedded to voting R. They're wedded to having a future. And I would think in an interesting way that the pandemic, as horrific as it is, has to be kind of a perverse asset for change, because the Republicans have so failed on this issue at every level. And your judge in Harris County, this young 29-year-old, I mean, she has shown vision, she has shown leadership, she has shown courage. And if you want to know what the future looks like, it's her. And she happens to be a Democrat. So you know what? I think her against your governor, her against Trump, if you are afraid, you want to go with her and not with them.
I think that's really, really true. I'm kind of surprised the reaction against Governor Abbott and Trump hasn't actually been bigger than it's been, to tell you the truth. And I think, and I agree that not only Hidalgo and Harris County, the county leader, has got rave reviews from even Republicans in the county for the job that she's done. But they really, I think it has cost Trump, you know, some number of voters in suburban areas that he got in 16, but not in enough for Biden to win Texas, but not the numbers I would have thought. I mean, and part of it is Republicans are simply more hierarchical and authoritarian than other parties, especially Democrats. And they don't leave their leaders quickly. I mean, it's almost like they give Dad a break. I mean, Dad might have gone bankrupt and we got tossed out in the street, but they don't leave Dad over it, right? And I think part of that's what's going on with some Texas Republicans. It's not as big as loss for Trump as I would have imagined.
Well, you know, and I think that the whole idea of Republican and Democrat, that's already it's losing its relationship. I mean, I look at my little state of New Hampshire, and the largest party in New Hampshire is undeclared. Okay, that's it. Like, they're like over 40 or 44% of the electorate is undeclared. And it's not that they don't lean left or lean right. It's that they don't feel any kind of benefit from affiliation, number one. Mm-hmm. They're not looking at their dad's party because, you know what, you know, the country today is so different from their father's anyway. And I think the whole party structure as a party is kind of losing its je ne sais quoi. All right. And people are, I always said that, especially I see this in New Hampshire, I don't know if it's going to be maybe true in your future, but I see that more and more politicians are running as independent contractors. Okay.
Well, yeah, sure. I mean, the parties change radically just in the media age of politics, really. I mean, media replaced their function so many ways. Right. I mean, in the era of Roosevelt, for instance, people participated because they made the decisions inside the conventions, et cetera, at the state level and the national level. And it was much more grassroots, if sometimes the occasional smoke-filled room and the machines and the big cities, that all happened. But media changed it radically. So most of the resources went to direct communications with voters. We've reached a point now where I think that's true. I mean, Texas doesn't have party registration. I mean, people say they're this party or that party, but nobody here registers. And independents are fully a third of the elected as far as we poll and find out.
Can I ask a question? Yeah, Glenn, didn't the machines used to work on patronage, political patronage? So there was a spoil system, and the machine gets somebody elected, and then the machine gets all of their local friends to get paid jobs in the administration. And that's no longer the way we fill civil service jobs. And
until Trump.
Until Trump. Yeah. Yes, patronage was a part of it. But there was another part of it that shouldn't be lost, which is the machines also got children tutored, got children health care, got people jobs outside of government, took right. care of people. They were there year round, day after day, mm-hmm. contacting people who at election time they go back to and say, vote for me. That's no longer the case. That was the bright side of the machine system. You mentioned the dark side, which was the patronage. They did lock people out of lucrative government jobs and contracts, no question.
So if you changed legislature after this election, and you see the Democrats controlling the House especially, how is Governor Abbott going to work with them? Because one of the things I see going into the future is obviously the economy has taken a huge hit. What we also know is that the pandemic has taken an enormous toll on Texas. But Texas is notorious for this reason. You have the highest percentage of uninsured in the United States. And now you have a pandemic. You didn't expand Medicaid. So what I'm trying to figure out is, what happens with a Democratic legislature? I mean the House, not the Senate, and Governor Abbott, because Governor Abbott, you know, he had to just sort of control his side of the aisle. Now he has to work across the aisle, and the pandemic has got to affect his ability to lead as well.
The answer to your question has more to do with internal Republican politics than it does statewide, both party politics, right? Because Abbott's going to have to decide whether to get things done or continue to pander to the extreme right wing in Texas. If it's the latter that he decides to do, he'll just turn the Democratic run Texas House into the monster he's trying to kill, right? He'll make them the devil and not do anything that the House might pass. And that'll leave the Democratic run House in a strong position of affecting redistricting, as you noted at the top of the show, and killing bad legislation, which every session the Republicans have a plate full of bad legislation that needs to be tossed in the garbage. So I think that's probably what we'll see in the early stages in any case, unless somehow there's a chastened Republican Party that decides the road to the future is more moderate.
Yeah.
But I don't see that happening immediately. I think it's the opposite.
So Ted Cruz is getting ready to run for president because I see him everywhere. I see him on CNN. I see him on Fox. I see him everywhere. So tell me a little bit about the future of Ted Cruz. Which Ted Cruz is going to show up? So he's been less of a schmuck than he was before he almost got beaten by Beto. It seems like he's gotten nicer. I mean, maybe I'm imagining it, but he's not always as out there. And now he seems to be like he's spinning the scenario for what the future of the Republican Party is, a la non-Trump. So tell me a little bit about what you see as Ted Cruz's future, because I would love to see him go back to somewhere. And I don't know where that somewhere is, but I'm kind of curious as to what you see happening for him.
I think that if your mean boyfriend or girlfriend is suddenly acting nicer, that's when you're really in danger. Okay. So I look at Ted Cruz that way. It's an act. It's an act. And it's a scary one at that. He's not very well liked by the party apparatus on the right across America. He'd have to fight his way through it again. And I don't think he makes it because of that in the end. He's just not liked well by Republicans across America. He's proven himself that he'll, you know, look what he did with Trump, who he one day condemned for saying his dad helped kill Kennedy and he had bad words about his wife. And that really made Cruz mad. But then he turned right around and made Trump his hero. I mean, what kind of character is that, right?
It is. So let's talk a little bit about the Senate race, though, because you do have a Senate race because, you know, Cornyn is up. And as you said, what's so interesting about Cornyn is does he have a political pulse in Texas? I mean, I get the sense that he's not a persona the way Ted Cruz is a persona. He's not a persona like your lieutenant governor. I know he's running. I know that this is going to be a very tough race for him, but I'm just trying to figure out that in this sort of political year, does he actually hold on to his seat? Since he hasn't really been this incredible firebrand, what does he offer Texas, especially in 2020?
I call him a miracle man. You know, I think I may have said this before on your show. It's because the guy manages to be an empty suit and a stuffed shirt at the same time. He's not well known for all the years he's held office, various offices across the state. And he really has made his career by just following others' lead. So he's not any sort of leader. I think it depends on the margin that Democrats can achieve in the overall race. If Biden wins, it's likely MJ stands a much better chance. But one thing about that to keep in mind is I think that Biden is going to get Republican voters, that some number, and those voters are going to go back to Cornyn out of feelings of conscience involving their party, right? They may even like MJ better, but they're going to say, well, I'm still a Republican. I just couldn't stand Trump, and I'm going to prove it by voting for Cornyn. And I think that's showing up in the polls even now.
All right, but so, let me remind you, this is the first year that you don't have straight ticket voting in Texas. So for the first time, people are going to actually have to look at the ballot. I mean, I think, and your ballot goes on and on and on. So it's going to be very interesting, because if Democrats were smart, they would be sort of teaching people how to use the ballot, number one. And number two, this is a very different political landscape, because they are going to actually go down and check boxes, and they don't have that muscle. Glenn?
Well, you know what? I think it might in the end hurt Republicans more than Democrats, if you want to know the truth. I think it might backfire on them.
Exactly.
First of all, most of the ballots, like the one here in Travis County, which is a pretty populous county, it's not that long. You know, all that makes it long are the state district judges at the local level. The other races are way up at the top, including the congressional district race and the state representative race, the U.S. Senate race, of course. So they don't have to go far down the ballot to vote those races. They just need to go, you know, down it. They're not as long as you might imagine. And I don't, you know, I just think people, people are shattering turnout records. The enthusiasm level has never been higher. I do not see them losing that enthusiasm after only clicking a name at the top and then leaving.
Exactly.
I think they'll follow through.
And well, who are the people who are enthusiastic? The Democrats, right?
Right, exactly.
Oh, yeah. In
exactly.
Bigger numbers, absolutely.
So I'm going to share with you that I posted this on Facebook, and I said, I have hope, okay, about what's going to happen on Tuesday. And Texas has got a lot of my hope riding on it. But this is how I defined hope. Hope is effort, not wish. Effort to make it so, not wish that it may be so. And we have seen a lot of effort in Texas. And I'm hoping that effort pays off. Glenn, it is just a pleasure. And I can't wait to talk to you again, because there'll be so much to recap. Anyway, take care. Ciao.
I'm going to go get with the work. Y'all take care. Love being with you.
All right.
Shout out the name of Lena Hidalgo.
Yes, she is amazing. Glenn. She is our future. She is our future. Yeah. I know it. This is the Tuesday edition of The Attitude with Arnie Arneson and Ken Barnes. We'll be right back.
And it was slippery in the hall. I was afraid that I might fall, cause I wasn't wearing trousers. Let the wind blow high, let the wind blow low, through the kilt and my sweets I go. All the lassies shout hello, Donald, where's your trousers? Let the wind blow high, let the wind blow low, through the streets of my kilt I go. All the lassies shout hello, Donald, where's your trousers? To wear the kilt is my delight. I'm never wrong, cause I'm always right. The Highlanders would get a fright if they saw me wearing trousers. Let the wind blow high, let the wind blow low, through the streets of a kilt I go. All the lassies shout hello, Donald, where's your trousers?
Welcome back to part two of the Tuesday edition of The Attitude with Arnie Arneson and producer Ken Barnes. Again, a little friendly reminder, we are Zooming this show on Monday night. So if something should happen Monday night, we'll probably be talking about it on Wednesday. There's a state that everybody is talking about. It's the state of Wisconsin. And I keep thinking, that's Scott Walker's state. Why are they talking about Wisconsin? But of course, it used to be Scott Walker's state. And yet when I think of Wisconsin, I always thought of sort of Wisconsin nice. You know, I actually worked in Milwaukee, Wisconsin for the Next Door Foundation on Milwaukee Ave when I was a young college student. And it was kind of this sort of liberal leaning Wisconsin. And then all of a sudden, I'm like, what happened? How do you explain what happened to Wisconsin? You see Donald Trump winning in 2016. You saw the rise of Scott Walker. And then I hear that the numbers in Wisconsin are now going through the roof, but not for Donald Trump, but for Joe Biden. So someone said, you need to talk to someone who's very knowledgeable about Wisconsin politics. His name is Tom Nelson. So let me welcome Tom Nelson to the program. Thank you, Tom, for joining us.
Great to be on my first and hopefully many, many, many shows to come.
Well, I hope so too. So first of all, who the hell are you, Tom?
And
why do people say, go to Tom? He knows.
Who's this guy?
Well, no, I happened to look at an article by my good friend, John Nichols. Well, he writes for The Nation magazine. He also writes for a local paper in Wisconsin. And he's impressed with Tom Nelson. So I figured if John Nichols is impressed with Tom Nelson, that at least is a good opening salvo for you. So who are you? So that my audience gets a sense of who you are, but more importantly, why you really have a handle on what's happening in Wisconsin, not just politically, but what's happening economically and socially. Because I think that description I had of Wisconsin nice, and then suddenly seeing the rise of Scott Walker, and then suddenly seeing the vote for Donald Trump really talks about, I think, a sense of frustration in Wisconsin. And that frustration was exercised at the voting booth.
So who I am. So I'm the county executive, which I know is a different kind of form of government than what is within what's in New Hampshire. And I think for most of New England, excuse them. So I'm the county executive here in the Fox Valley, which is part of the greater Appleton area, just south of Green Bay. New York Times today came out with the story about one of a handful of bellwether states is Brown County, which is the county just to the north of us. And also the New York Times last week had a article talking about how important the Fox Valley in general is. And in particular, what was really exciting about this is they dropped a pin, if you will, on the map. Where would Ground Zero be, and where the independent votes are, the persuadable votes that would swing Wisconsin and ultimately swing the presidency. And it was actually my hometown of Little Chute, Wisconsin. It was wonderful. So I walked around with Reed Epstein from the New York Times, socially distanced, of course. And, you know, he asked me about growing up in the Fox Valley, being county executive, the challenges that we have, being county executive in one of the hottest of the hot spots, which is what I had in my launch video against Ron Johnson, which we'll talk about later. But the way I describe voters in the Fox Valley, and there's only one place in the state that would appreciate this comparison, which is, we are the New Hampshire of the general election voters.
That, everyone, is in the New York Times article entitled "In Critical Wisconsin, the Fox Valley May Decide the State's Winner." I read that and I'm going, wait a minute, what do you know about New Hampshire that you could actually describe this? So since I ran for governor and Congress in New Hampshire, I know my state very well.
You
so
do.
The fact that this is a sort of parallel experience of Fox Valley, describe what you mean by that. Is it that it's got this rural sort of community, that it's got this sort of urban college level community? What is it about the Fox Valley that makes it both unique in this way and also so pivotal?
Well, I have kind of a personal connection to New Hampshire from many, many years ago. I dated a girl from New Hampshire, and I came and visited her family a couple of summers. And so I had, you know, what I picked up in New Hampshire, my time there, reminded me a lot of back home for the reasons that you just gave. But the other thing that I picked up, and I learned this from my very, very short time in New Hampshire, is that you take your politics very seriously. And I did some phone calling for then Senator Obama back in 2007. And I had some time before my flight back home. It dropped me off. I did some dialing, you know. And what I was struck by is I would talk to a voter, and then there would be like a list of all these lines underneath it. It had like Obama, Clinton, Edwards, Clinton, Obama. And I'm like, I don't understand this. Well, it turned out that people were changing their mind back and forth these different candidates. And what that told me is that people take their politics very seriously in New Hampshire. And not only that, though, but they expect a lot of attention. They expect candidates to come into their home, to go to, I know that you don't have fish fries, but community gatherings like that. The same thing here. I mean, we've been used to having a lot of presidential visits, surrogate visits, not necessarily during the primary, but definitely in the general election and all throughout the fall. In fact, it's not just here in the Fox Valley, it's around the state, but there's particular attention that is focused here. And it's because of the number of persuadable voters. And it's because people take their politics very seriously. I will say this though, there is kind of a higher threshold for Democrats. The way that I describe independent voters here, describe them as default Republicans.
Okay.
What that means is historically people here predisposed to vote for Republicans. And that's for a number of reasons. We haven't had a lot of local Democratic elected officials, legislators, county executives, mayors, and so forth in all of the constitutional offices for county government, clerk of courts, county clerk, all of those individuals are Republicans. But people are beginning to move a little bit more and more to the left. And so there is an opening for Democrats to come in, but you need to have a good candidate. You need to have a good message, and you have to have someone that's going to work hard, which is what I did when I first ran in 2004. I defeated a Republican incumbent in a Republican district and in a Republican year. And I did that by going door to door 22,000 times.
Yeah.
I knocked on 22,000 doors, and I felt like I physically moved this district politically from the red column into the blue column. And one of the reasons why I was able to do that is I spend so much time, it's like developing a personal relationship with every constituent I had though, but they saw that I worked hard. And a work ethic has no peer when it comes to the Midwest. And I also had that sense
I agree with you, but tell me something about Wisconsin, because right now the numbers are incredible for what they may produce for Joe Biden, which I am ecstatic about. But I have this nightmare called Scott Walker. And the fact that they had a recall, what produced Scott is what I'm trying to figure out, because that also then produced the vote for Trump. It also produced, I think, this sort of concern that they had to spend time in Wisconsin, because Wisconsin had always been somewhat of a more reliable state when it came to sort of at least presidential politics for Democrats. Mm-hmm. And then shock of shocks. But why they should be shocked is if they looked at Scott Walker, why did they think that Hillary Clinton was going to win? I mean, what I'm trying to figure out is, where is the frustration and the move away from the Democrats? What did Democrats not do for voters in Wisconsin that would make them embrace Scott Walker, that would make Donald Trump a winner, and that people needed to sort of come back and sort of rehabilitate their relationship?
I'll tell you what, I knew the answer to that.
But not just Scott Walker, I'm sorry, but the legislature is all Republican. And Supreme Court is Republican. I mean, Ron Johnson, it's the whole.
And I can talk about Ron Johnson too, if you like, for a while.
Yeah, yeah.
So I ran against Scott Walker when I ran for Lieutenant Governor with Tom Barrett. He is an exceptional campaigner. He works very hard. He grabbed onto a message that year that people were responding to, of course. Or I think the days of Wisconsin being a blue state, I think we're purple in some parts of the state, like my part of the state. I would describe us not as red or blue or purple, but more of maroon. And I hate to take this metaphor, too far though.
Yeah, that's right.
But it goes to my point about having these default Republicans. But I don't know. I mean, with Scott Walker, it was a mystery. Not just did he get, not only did he win once, but he won three times. And in my county, he won four times. And I think a lot of that had to do with national trends that in some states like Wisconsin are amplified. And in 2009, so lead up to the 2010 elections, first term of President Obama, I was in the state assembly. It was my third term. I was majority leader. And we were running the tables. We had two U.S. senators, I think five of the eight members of Congress. We had majorities in the assembly, state senate.
Exactly.
And I think all of the statewide offices, constitutional offices, except for attorney general. And we lost everything.
It's unbelievable.
Just wiped right off. It was, I think we were the state that lost. We lost more in Wisconsin than I think any other state in the country. And we still have not recovered from that. And one of the reasons why we're not recovered from that is because of gerrymandering. There's really no two ways around that. we have such severe gerrymandering that I'm very, very concerned about tomorrow, that despite the fact that this is going to, God willing, be a good Democratic year, and because we have so much room to grow, because, I mean, the strategy earlier this year from the Republicans, we had a program called Save the Veto. So even though that this was going to be a Democratic year, we had a program called Save the Veto, which means to stop going into a supermajority into either house. Well, I think the Republicans are finally back on their heels on that. I think that we should be okay with this. But we are still going to have difficulty turning the seats Democratic, the ones that you would normally be able to do if you did not have such severe gerrymandering. So I think what we're going to learn tomorrow, one of the lessons is we are going to learn just how bad gerrymandering is here, because I think that you would look at this map and then compare it to something that'd be less severe. And I know, you know, I hope we take back as many seats as possible, but you'll look at that with gerrymandering, not with gerrymandering, and we will most certainly pick up
you have
more
a little,
seats.
But look at the reaction of your Republican legislature to the pandemic. They have not been helpful. No. They have been, I mean, and now it's raging.
It's criminal. It's absolutely
raging
criminal
in Wisconsin. And I think that has to be on people's minds when they go in and exercise the franchise today, which is Tuesday, because they are looking at this and they are realizing that this has consequences, not just for their health, not just for their kids going to school. It's going to have huge consequences on the economy, especially if the economy starts really sort of in a tailspin. Right. This, and the one thing I'm going to sort of challenge you on about gerrymandering is that when you look at gerrymandering, you have to go back a decade, okay? Because these are districts that were created 10 years ago. I don't know what the movement pattern has been in Wisconsin, whether you've seen an influx or an outflow, but usually the weakest time for a gerrymandered district is in the last 2 years. And guess what? You now have Joe Biden doing incredibly well. You have Republicans horrifically responding to this incredible pandemic and not being helpful in addressing it. And you're at the end of that, you know, decade of gerrymandering. If there was ever a time for you to be successful, you would think that there would be a synergistic effect that this would happen. And I am going to be looking at Fox Valley because of you, Mr. Nelson, but also because of the New York Times, because it will be really interesting to see how this bellwether really changes, because it really does say that the Democrats have not only figured out a message, but that voters are now in some ways coming back to trust that maybe they can resolve some of their problems.
I think that's going to be the test tomorrow to see just how severe gerrymandering was. I am fearful that it really was so bad that it's still going to be more difficult for us. I mean, it's going to be very difficult for us to win back the seats we should have won, you know, just because normally, as you said before, it's going to dissipate over time. But we knew at the very beginning, look, legislators, when they were doing all the redistricting going on in 2011, and they accelerated that timetable because they were concerned that they were going to lose a majority in the state Senate before they would complete redistricting. And the way that they went about doing that was so underhanded.
I know.
That they actually had every legislator, I think every legislator, sign a non-disclosure form about what was being discussed behind closed doors on redistricting. I mean, this group, I mean, they are just a bunch of criminals. And it's gone from messing up our process, our democratic process, all the way up near right now to a pandemic. And Arnie, I want to correct you, not only are they not doing anything, but they're stopping others from doing something, specifically the governor. They sued the governor at Wisconsin State Supreme Court, which is basically a branch office of the Republican Party. And they said, this is not right. We should have a seat at the table to write statewide COVID policy. And so they found in their favor. And of course, Republicans, here we are, 5.5 months later, they still have not produced a plan. That is the kind of frustration that we're
dealing with. So how do you not take this story you just told me and the incredible numbers about Wisconsin and COVID? I mean, these are incredible. I think you're the third worst in the United States. And that's saying something, since the United States is like one of the worst in the world. So we have to, like, you know, really sort of grade it upwards in a horrific way. How do you not show their behavior that the Supreme Court in Wisconsin has basically aided and abetted this in bad behavior? Right. And this behavior now is costing people's lives. It's harming your medical system. It's again, I'm just trying to figure out what happened to Wisconsin nice. What happened to the sort of Wisconsin that you always sort of thought was thoughtful, like Fox Valley, as you said, that they're not in one pocket or another. They're more independent. They're looking at this. And if you're putting all those pieces on the table, how do you support a Republican that basically is undermining everything that you value and something that ultimately will undermine your future? Even if this is a crapshoot, I wouldn't want to go with the Republican crap. I'd rather at least try something different.
Right. Well, we have seen now there was a poll taken in the spring about the approval rating for the state legislature, and now in a completely flip, it might have been, I think, 52 approve, and now it's down to like 34, 35, or 36. I mean, it was night and day. And the Republicans were just running so scared that I think a week or 2 weeks ago, they were actually talking about, okay, maybe we need to do something about the pandemic. Well, that lasted about 2 or 3 days, and they turned around. I think the Speaker of the House said, well, we can't do anything because it's a virus, something like that. That's right. I mean, it's just completely absurd. And it's not just the pandemic. I mean, this group, they're not legislators, they're litigators. They have spent more time in court than they have on the floor of the assembly. It's 2 days for the entire year. They haven't been in office, I think. They haven't been on the floor for like 150 or 200 days. And it's not just pandemic. That's the worst. I went around and I gave a virtual tour of all of the county parties, talking about local leaders leading in the age of pandemic. White House isn't doing anything. The governor can't do anything. So it's down to mayors and county executives. We are leading the country in the fight against COVID, which is my main message running for the Senate. But it was not just that. But there was also the issue about voting rights. My wife was a co-plaintiff in a major Voting Rights Act lawsuit that was just judged last week. The decision coming back that clerks, we asked for clerks to have 6 additional days after Election Day to be able to count absentee ballots, as long as those absentee ballots were postmarked by Election Day. And the Supreme Court ruled against it. That was my wife's case. That was another issue. You can go on and on and on. Right. And, that's a big message that I'm talking about running for the Senate against Ron Johnson. Of course, my opponent is going to be Ron Johnson, but part of this is going to be a bigger story about what's happening with the Republican Party all throughout the state, in the legislature in particular. And we need to start doing something that you have elected officials at the local level, from the courthouse to the state house, all the way up to the White House, that are going to put people first, that are going to be, what is in the best interest of families in the Fox Valley and across the state. That's not happening right now. Those are basic, simple things an elected official should do. And if you do not do that, you're unfit for office.
So the best line is that they're not legislators, they're litigators. And that's an incredible line that you have to hold on to, because first of all, nobody likes lawyers anyway. Let's be honest here, okay? I mean, no, I'm going to be here. And you didn't send them to litigate. You sent them to produce policy. You sent them to solve problems. You sent them to address what's happening economically and socially and medically. And the idea that they are litigating and they're not producing is something. And of course, the sad news is Donald Trump is actually mirroring that, because what did he say? We're going to send in our lawyers. So we don't trust the vote. We don't respect the voter. We want to make sure that, voter suppression is kind of the name of the game. And so instead of you being able to make a decision, they want a court to make a decision, because they're going to litigate it. They're not going to allow an election to take place. So you have a lot going in your favor. Before I let you go, though, I have to quickly ask. So you want to run against Ron Johnson. Ron is up in 2022. My understanding is he said he was only going to run for 2 terms. What happened?
He's changing his tune. Beginning of last week. So I announced last week, Monday, great fanfare, terrific reception. I have never realized, I knew this guy was unpopular, but he is a lightning rod around the state. People give me accolades. Finally, someone stepped up to take this guy on. It's been 4 years since he was elected. And at the beginning of last week, they asked him, so this Tom Nelson guy is running. I know Tom Nelson. And are you going to run? I'm like, well, I wasn't planning to, something along those lines. And then Wednesday or Thursday when the New York Times story landed, it said that he was leaning toward doing it. So look, the dial goes from, well, I'm not really going to do it, all the way to, hey, I think I might be doing that. So the question, is he going to run again? If I was a betting man, I would say he would. And that is a big reason why I started early. Not only am I the first announced candidate to run against Ron Johnson, but I believe I might be the first announced candidate running for the U.S. Senate anywhere across the country. I think that just goes to speak the gravity of the situation here in Wisconsin and the absolute poor leadership we've had from people like Ron Johnson. He's a joke. Here's the same guy who said, I want to, it is so important to confirm Amy Coney Barrett that I will go on the floor in a moon suit because of COVID if I absolutely have to. The same guy that said that took a COVID test, turns around, goes to a fundraiser and puts people at risk.
I know. In a lot of ways, again, this pandemic is creating interesting opportunities and in a horrific way. This is going to be a terrible winter. And even people that don't want to believe it or think that they're going to survive it are going to see a situation they have never, ever envisioned. And the behavior of Ron Johnson by doing that shows this sort of like that he doesn't appreciate the consequences of this disease, and the disease is huge. So before I let you go, Tom, on the spectrum, my understanding is that you were a Bernie delegate to this convention. So I am looking at Wisconsin, and you compared it a little bit to New Hampshire, at least the Fox Valley. And what I see in New Hampshire is that there are two New Hampshires. There is the more urban, sort of more mass-oriented, highly technical, highly educated part of my state. And then there is the rural part of my state. And the rural part of my state has seen incredible economic devastation. We used to have paper mills. We don't have paper mills. We don't have infrastructure, so we don't have any way to get there from here. You know, now that everyone's going online to educate their kids, they don't have good, you know, internet access. I am seeing this huge resentment within rural New Hampshire, because for all the quote unquote good things that Democrats claim they do, it's never trickled up to them. They've never seen the consequences of jobs, of really significant healthcare. I mean, they're losing their rural hospitals. So I am trying to figure out that as you look at running against Ron Johnson, it's not just running against a Republican, it's what kind of a Democrat are you? And what are you seeing as the future for the Democratic Party? What is the agenda?
I will be the progressive candidate. You mentioned that I'm a Bernie delegate. So let's talk about that first of all. I'm a Bernie delegate from a red county and a county executive that's been elected, elected and reelected three times in the state assembly, elected, reelected three times also in a red district. So what's someone like me in Joe McCarthy's old county being a Bernie delegate? Many reasons, but for the reason that you just explained, bread and butter issues. And Bernie Sanders came here in 2016 and campaigned. He ended up winning 71 of the 72 counties. Yes, we have 72 counties.
Unbelievable.
He did so well. He did so well because he was genuine, he was honest, and he was speaking to bread and butter issues. And if there's any audience, if there's any audience in the country that will respond to that, it would be a state like Wisconsin or New Hampshire, where you have that kind of mix of urban, rural, agriculture, manufacturing. I'm almost exactly the same. Dairy, paper. By the way, I have a book coming out on the paper industry, labor history, what it means for American manufacturing. I worked with United Steelworkers to save a mill. Book's coming out in January, and I can come back and talk about that.
Yeah,
but the question about Bernie, I mean, there have been very, very few people, Elizabeth Warren, a number of others that have been able to move the Democratic Party back to its progressive morals. And I think that has made such a substantial contribution. He's the reason. He's the reason, like issues about healthcare, jobs, trade, racial injustice, all of those issues are on the front burner now because of what he did, not just in 2020, but the work that he did in 2016. The bread and butter issues they talked about in 20 and 16 are exactly the kind of issues that affect people in Wisconsin.
Didn't Wisconsin, the home of the Farmer Labor Party, weren't they the progressives long before Joe McCarthy?
That was that's Minnesota. That's
Minnesota.
Democratic. However, that was the DFL, still called the DFL, but they were the same kind of coalitions that we had back in the 1930s and 19, and I think Ken, this is what you might be speaking about, is that you had farmers, you had the socialists out of Milwaukee, you had the progressives, and so they tried to form this coalition. This coalition was actually going to be rooted in a kind of labor party, and I think John Nichols may have talked about that, or would be happy to talk about that. That happened in the 1930s. A lot of great things happened in legislature. Right. So when you talk about the historical reputation of Wisconsin, it's that era. It wasn't, you know, the early beginning of the Democratic Party with Gaylord Nelson, Bill Proxmire in the late 1950s, on 60s and so forth. But
exactly.
It really happened at that time. So the roots where this state comes back to are the roots that were planted back in the 30s, and the 40s, progressives.
I'm going to need to let you go, Tom Nelson, but I'm going to remind everyone there was a book that I read many, many years ago by E.J. Dionne called Why Americans Hate Politics. And I think you need to read it again, because in a lot of ways, it's because they want to know that they can go to a doctor when they're sick. They want to know that they're earning enough money so that they can, you know, basically afford a house. It's all these basic things. And when you see what happened in so many places like Wisconsin, in northern New Hampshire, in so many places around the Rust Belt, and you realize that people weren't getting the wages they needed, weren't being able to go to a doctor, looked at their kids and saw the kind of debt that they were going into, and that they felt invisible. And I think what you said about Bernie and what you said about Elizabeth Warren is they saw them. They saw them. And that was important. And I'm hoping that if Joe Biden wins on Tuesday, that we really not only deliver, you know, Donald Trump out of the White House, but that we see America. Because right now there's a lot of hurting people, and there's an opportunity here for us to address that. We've addressed Wall Street enough. It's time for us to address Main Street and the rest of America. Tom Nelson, thank you so much. Good luck Tuesday. This is the day we're talking, actually. It's going to be very, very interesting to see how big the sweep is. And I hope it changes numbers underneath as well. Take care. Thank you so much.
Thanks, Ken. Appreciate it.
All right, Joe. This is the Tuesday edition of The Attitude with Arnie Arneson and producer Ken Barnes. We will schmooze tomorrow. Lots to talk about.